City Talk 105.9 official podcasts online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on City Talk 105.9.
Elizabeth Noble is the author of a string of best-selling books, including The Reading Group, Alphabet Weekends, and Things I Want My Daughters to Know. Now, if you're a guy, you might have just dismissed her books as chick lit, but I reckon if you're a woman, the chances are you're one of her growing legion of fans. Elizabeth's stories of family life, relationships, and the complexities of modern living have won her millions of devoted readers, not just here, but also in her adopted USA. Her latest book, The Girl Next Door, was published last week, and she joins me now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Welcome back to England.
Thank you. Lovely to be back in England.
Now, I did mention the dreaded chick lit phrase in the introduction. do you object to that tag?
I don't object to any tag as long as people read and enjoy my books. I don't have any delusions of grandeur. The only thing I ever say about chick lits is that my chicks are usually a little bit older than chicks. So,
yes.
You know, I'm not sure hen lit's such an attractive phrase, but they're a little bit more grown up than your average chick. But no, I don't object.
You don't mind. All right, but what I find interesting is you began your career behind the scenes, didn't you? You were in publishing first.
Yes.
So when did you decide to cross over and start writing, or was that always the plan?
Well, I think my mum would tell you I was always a scribbler and always a storyteller. I've always been insatiably nosy, which I think is the number one criteria for a contemporary women's novelist. Mm. I didn't decide that I was going to try it myself until I had my second daughter, and I was at home with her, and she was just about old enough to go to nursery school, and I thought, well, it's time to, if you're ever going to put your money where your mouth is, you should try now, otherwise you will have to go back out into the big bad workplace and get a proper job. So I'd never attempted to write, you know, write for money, if you like,
yeah,
until my youngest daughter was 3 or 4, and then I sat down and had a go.
But do you think your knowledge of the business affected your choice of what you wrote and how you wrote?
Well, I think that contemporary women's fiction is probably the most crowded genre there is. It's probably the hardest one and the most competitive. But there was never any question that it was my natural home. It's what I wanted to write about. I love to read, and I read all sorts of different things. But I wanted to write contemporary women's lives. So I think understanding the business a little bit, although I would have to say that my knowledge is horribly out of date now, and the business has changed a great deal. It's a blessing and a curse. Sometimes a bit of ignorance is bliss. But understanding that it's a business and understanding a little bit about the way it works has definitely been helpful.
What's the curse bit then?
Well, you understand about sales figures and discounts and returns and
pulping and
yes, pulping.
Offers.
Oh gosh, you understand about pulping. Yes, you know about you understand the business side a little bit more, and it's not quite. It's a wonderful profession, full of wonderful people, but it is also a business, you know.
You would have made a big cross from working in an office to the solitary life of a writer. Was that difficult?
Can be very lonely, and I think that came most to the fore when I moved to America, because obviously when I was doing it, when I lived in England, I still had my whole life and family and friends and support network around me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lonely job, but then the sort of bizarre thing is that you then go out and publicise, which is an incredibly sociable thing to do.
Yes,
so
yes.
I always thought I was very lucky that I could work from home. I didn't miss anything with my kids. I was able to do every pickup, every sports day, every prize giving. But at the same time, once in a while, I put dry clean only clothing on and, you know, go out and be a grown up in my own right. So I consider myself very blessed.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, The Girl Next Door has just been published. Is there a scary time when you've published the book and you wait for the critics? Do you scour through the newspapers and think, what have they written? Do you rage silently at some of them and cheer?
Absolutely. You can't hide from reviews. And it is a bit like taking your baby out in the pram and having people lean in and say, well, she's all right, but her eyes are a bit close together. You know, it's very personal to you what you've written. And although I always think that you should listen, because I think listening is how you learn in every area of your life, yes, you're very, very vulnerable. And there are avenues of criticism that, of course, you have no answer to. If someone write something mean in the newspaper, or I tell you, the classic places, the online retail, the Amazons of this world, where it seems to me that some people's main hobby is to go on and write mean things. You can't come back at that, and that can sometimes be frustrating. But, you know, that's the game.
Yes, yes. And you enter the game knowing the rules.
Exactly. If you didn't want anyone to comment, you should keep your manuscript in the knicker drawer and not take any money for it, you know?
Now, it's Mother's Day, of course. Now, before we talk about your new book in depth, I'd like to ask you about the last one, Things I Want My Daughters to Know. Now, apparently, in one interview, you call that book your most autobiographical novel. So, obviously, you are a mother of two daughters. So, what was the idea behind that book, and how much did you draw on your own life experience?
A lot. Although, obviously, the storylines change. I always say the names have been changed to protect me. I am a daughter, and I have a mother. We all do. My own mother is a fantastic, wonderful, omnipresent feature in my life. She lost her mother when she was in her early 20s, before she was married and had children. And I've grown up knowing how profound that was for her. Yeah. And I'm blessed that I still have her. And then, of course, I had my own two daughters, Tallulah and Ottilie. And I think the minute you have a baby, your greatest fear is transferred from being something that's about you to that something that's being about them. And it's being separated, whether it's you losing them or them losing you, is a paralyzing, sick in the middle of the night kind of feeling that I think comes with motherhood. Yes. And it was, in that sense, conjuring my character's very different. She's at a different age and stage. And I fortunately haven't been ill, but it's very easy, I think, for any mother to imagine the feeling that you would have if you were going to be taken away from your children. Yes. However old they are, I think you realise as a mother, it's never over. You're a mother forever.
I know. Most people know, I've just got the all clear from having had breast cancer.
Hurrah!
Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. And yeah, it's absolutely true with your daughters. Absolutely true. You think, you do bargains with anyone who'll listen.
Yes,
up there.
Yes, absolutely. And there's this great sense, and I think one of the great tricks of motherhood is that you're there and you give advice and you have a view, but you stand back and let them be their own people. But I think there's always a sense that, particularly the heroine of Things I Want My Daughters to Know, is convinced that none of her girls don't need her anymore, and whether they know it or not, you know. And so she leaves behind all these letters and diary entries and journal entries in which she tells them the things she wants them to know, and things about them, things about her, things about life. You know, she's possessed with the need to leave behind something that's going to help them after she's gone, even if they're not quite ready to admit they need the help.
Yeah, I think that's a very motherly thing. But is it different when you're the mother, stepmother to a son? Is it different with boys?
Yes, and there's actually such a close age gap between myself and my stepson. I married a man who's almost 20 years older than me. If he was listening, he would insist that I said 18. Those 2 years make a big difference to him. And my stepson is only 12 years younger. So I was in the very lucky position of not ever having to try and be his mum. He has a mum he's very close to. I was able to be much more a friend, and in fact, as a older person, he said it was fantastic to have someone who was in the middle. I was not so old, he found it impossible to imagine that I could relate to any of his situations, nor so young that I didn't have some sage words for him. So I never expected I would end up with, what do they call us, blended families.
Oh,
it wasn't necessarily what I set out to achieve for myself, but I love that I have that. And I now realize that my girls have a brother who is exactly that middle stage for them. So when they're teenagers and they think their dad and I don't know anything, they'll be able to go to William and the same thing.
Well, if the language and what have you changes so quickly, he'll probably be out of vogue very
quickly.
But
I hope he seems less cryogenically frozen to them than I'm sure that we will.
Let me just remind our listeners, I'm talking to author Elizabeth Noble. Elizabeth, we're talking about motherhood on Mother's Day, so I've got to throw this one in. I don't know if you've been aware, but the novelist Julie Myerson, she's been all over the news in the last few weeks.
Absolutely, I'm aware.
Yes, a lot of flack for writing about her teenage son and his skunk use and what happened. And then it's been going to and fro in the press. So brings me to ask you, what do you think about this as a writer and a mother? Would you ever do that to your daughters?
I don't think so. I would start by saying it's hard for me to imagine that as a mother she wouldn't have her son's best interests at heart, and I always assume that about a mother unless I get really strong evidence otherwise. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that it's done him any favours to drag him into the public eye. I'm not so much in judgment of throwing him out, although I think,
I don't think anybody has been.
No,
really.
I think tough love is a proven method of helping people in those circumstances sometimes. Yeah, yeah. But I don't know why we need to know about it, and I don't know if he will find it easy to forgive her for that.
And it'll always be around.
It'll always be around. And I tell stories about my children, but only ones that I'm pretty sure they wouldn't. I mean, they're thrilled if ever they hear their name on the radio or see it in print. They're young enough to still find it wildly exciting. But some things are private.
Absolutely.
And I hope I would always be as respectful of their boundaries as I am of my own. So in general,
that's an interesting one. When you say respectful of your own boundaries, so I'm guessing that you use elements of yourself in the book, but are there certain bits that are no-go areas? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it would. I wouldn't ever sit down and write about my marriage in incredibly intimate terms, because that's my marriage. And yes, I think if you want to write, if you want to connect with your audience and you want to reach a readership, you want to have a dialogue with your reader, then you have to open yourself up to a degree. And a shared experience and common ground is really important. But there are lines. I think everybody has lines. I'm sure you have lines in what you will and won't share with complete strangers. So I guess everyone has them in a different place in the sand. But I don't see that. Looking forward, I don't see Mother's Day Sunday lunches being easy in the Meyerson household for a while.
No, and either with the other children after the news at the Guardian column was about all of them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That should either have never been written or should always have been kept a secret, I think.
Now, Elizabeth, with your own life, I'm guessing the more successful you become writing, do you find yourself operating further and further away from the people to whom you are writing to? Is there ever a stage where an author moves into such a rarefied atmosphere, they're in danger of connecting or losing that connection with their readers?
I guess there must be. I got to tell you, I'm some way from that. That would be nice. No, I would hate that. I think I still find people incredibly interesting, and I like to think that even if I hit the lofty heights of J.K. Rowling, I would still find people interesting. And what I think is great about people is that everybody has a story, and if you are approachable and open and interested, people will tell you those stories. And of course, I never steal anybody's story word for word, but everything informs. You know, everything's a little nugget that you file away.
But do you actively go out like a little bowerbird seeking?
Like a journalist. No, and I don't have a dictaphone in my handbag at all times, but I will, if you sit next to me on a train, I will get you talking. It's a flaw, probably. But people, you know, people fascinate me, and people's lives and the way lives can be so different yet the same. And I was really interested when my first novel did well in America. It sort of flabbergasted me that a novel that seemed to me so incredibly English could speak to an American audience. But I think that just proves that we're all pretty much the same. However much money you've got, wherever you live in the country or the world, we've all got the same issues going on.
Yeah, and you brought up that fact that you now live in the UK and America. What do you reckon are the main differences between our two countries? Do you have any qualms about your children growing up in the States?
The differences are harder to spot than you would think. I've said this before. I think that because we have a common language and because we are so thoroughly immersed in American culture with television and films and music, we think we know what we're doing. And I would also make the the strong point that New York's not really America. It's like a little republic on its own, stuck on the edge. You go off Manhattan into America, and it's a different again. But the differences are subtle, but fairly powerful. Certainly in my experience, I went from a tiny village to the middle smack bang of the city.
Whoa.
It's a fabulous city for kids with a million things to do. It's safe and it's clean, and children are not welcomed in the same way they are, say, in the Mediterranean. They don't stay up all night, but they are a really important part of society in New York. So they're having a great time. But what amuses and endears me about them is they consider themselves still to be ridiculously English.
Do they have American accents, though?
No, not really. There was a stage when they wavered, and they can certainly do it. If it's required, they'll do it. And when they come home, they put it on a bit for their friends. But in America, they sound pretty English. Like, they've obviously decided they're going to keep it, so...
All right. Well, let's come where I want to end up, because what I want people to remember is that your new book, The Girl Next Door. Now, that again, you're looking at different experiences of motherhood. We've got the main character lonely away from family and friends in New York, which I'm guessing you must have gone through.
It's my little ode to loneliness. Yes.
Is it?
It was very interesting. I was 37 when we went, and I by no means went unwillingly. My husband was offered a job he really wanted to do, but was a group decision. And I embraced the experience. You know, we sold up here. We sold our house and moved over and bought a place. So we were really committed to it.
Yeah.
But I thought I was pretty clear on who I was when I went to New York. And we sort of landed in the middle of the Upper West Side. My kids go to school on the Upper East Side. And that's a pretty unique place. And I was amazed at how quickly my confidence sort of shook and then crumbled. And I,
Because you sound so confident. What would have freaked you out?
I didn't look right. I didn't...
you weren't thin enough.
I wasn't. Oh, God. But not by a long chalk. Not thin enough. Not groomed enough. Not dressed, you know, the way that the other people were. And I felt out of place. You know, it was enormously discombobulating. And, of course, when you're not confident, you don't find it as easy to put yourself out there. And I sort of... The kids were at school, which, of course, is a ready-made life. My husband was in the office, which is another ready-made life. Not without problems. And I was at home in front of the screen writing a book that made me cry every day. Because I was... When we moved, I was finishing off Things I Want My Daughters to Know. So... It took a really long time. I always say the first year was the honeymoon, when we thought, yeah, hey, how exciting, how cool are we?
Yes.
The second year was the, oh my God, put me on a plane, I want to go home year. And it didn't really click and get real until year three, which is the one we're in now.
Yeah, no, but in your book, in The Girl Next Door, your lonely character away from family and friends in New York suddenly decides she wants a baby. Is that something you went through? Did you think, if I had another child, it would sort of fill up a bit of time?
Well, if I wasn't so past that, then it might have done, because there's certainly a big collective baby boom on the Upper East Side, and everybody goes up and down Madison Avenue all day with their fancy strollers. And you do think, maybe if I had one of those, I could play with you. But no, those years are behind me, I'm afraid. But Eve definitely thinks that having a baby might be her entree into a social life that she would enjoy.
Yeah.
But if my husband heard that, he'd be shrieking with horror.
Crossing himself.
Yeah.
Now, you've got another character, her neighbour, who lost her daughter and husband in a tragic accident.
Mm.
Is that about, again, what we touched upon before, your fears? You know that feeling of, oh, my gosh, this is just such a gorgeous family. I'm just so happy here.
Mm.
Oh, you know, every so often you think, oh, what if?
I wanted just a little background. Eve moves into this building where there are a lot of neighbours all having a very interesting time, this being a novel. And one of the women she befriends is a much older English woman, Violet Wallace, who's been in America since the 40s. She went over as a war bride in 46 and reveals her story and her background to Eve over a period of months. You know, she's been a private, secretive, very quiet person, and it all comes out. And what I was trying to do was draw parallels. You know, Eve takes great comfort from her friendship with Violet, but in the same way, Violet is going to find Eve incredibly helpful in sort of dealing with some things she really hasn't dealt with for a very long time. But yes, Violet is a broken person, broken by the experience she's had, and she's sort of put herself to sleep. She functions and you wouldn't know anything was wrong with her, but there's this great tragedy behind her.
And lastly, there's another character who's very overprotective of her daughter, who was conceived through IVF. Did you have anything on which to draw?
Yeah, no, I'm ridiculously fecund. My husband would tell you he only has to look at me and I'm pregnant. and very, very lucky. But I do have a number of friends and know a number of people for whom it hasn't come so easily. And I'm familiar, therefore, with that, with the dreadful, dreadful sort of sadness that weighs on people who want to be pregnant and can't be pregnant. And how I know from experience of people close to me that sometimes those babies are really, they're hard to let go of because they're so hard won and so precious. And it's not to say that those of us who conceive easily and naturally are flippant about our children,
but
we don't necessarily have the same sort of fears hovering over us, and it's sometimes quite hard for them to let go. And I wanted to write about that.
So do you think, drawing just, those are just, you know, some of the characters, is there a message behind The Girl Next Door, do you think? Do you set off with a message? Are you one of these writers who thinks, right, you know, this is what the book's going to be about, this is going to be my message, or do you just sit down
really.
And start
and
writing?
And I don't ever want to preach. I think the message, the message is that humanity sort of is everywhere. And going back to what I said, everyone has a story. And I think what's interesting about an apartment building, particularly one in New York, is that the doors are closed and it's all going on behind the doors. And then you get out and you get in the lift and you don't have a clue what's going on with the person standing next to you in the lift. I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish. We should all be nicer to each other, but we probably should.
Wow, saying that in New York. Well, do you know, the only time I think it mellowed out was immediately after 9/11. And I remember going out there and thinking, my goodness, it's thawing. Yeah. And we go over quite regularly because we have a home in the States. And the last time I went over, I just thought, no, we're back to basics.
You know what it is, though? I always feel the need to say that I don't think New Yorkers are rude so much as they are
honest.
Efficient, exactly. They don't want any flannel. They don't want any small talk. They want to know what you want, and they want, they want everything sort of done briskly at the right speed. That said, there is nothing ruder in the universe than a rude New Yorker. But they're few and far between. Mostly they're just going so fast that there isn't time for any niceties.
So while you're here in England, what niceties will you indulge in? When you come back here, do you think so? Right.
Well, not to sound shallow, but let's just say the Marks and Spencer's Food Hall and John Lewis will feature. Seeing my friends, I've persuaded someone that I don't want to go to a nice restaurant. I really want fish and chips out of a paper bag, because although we have fish and chips in New York, they cook them in something like fat-free fat, and it's just not the same. And I have a long list of crisps and sweeties to take back for my girls.
Oh, yes, because they can't do chocolate.
They can't do chocolate. No, tastes like wax.
Yes.
I wish I could say something cultural, like I want to go to the National Portrait Gallery and look at the art. But really, it's much more of a sort of comfort food, familiar. And if I can catch an episode of Coronation Street, I'll be super happy. But they keep booking me out in the evenings, so I miss it.
I'm sure after this you'll get Granada to send you a DVD of it. What's next, Elizabeth, after The Girl Next Door? What's any plans for another book? Have
you
already started another book?
Numbers 6 and 7 are in the pipeline. I'm going to write a sequel to The Girl Next Door, which may or may not be called The Guy Upstairs, but it's going to follow some of the characters from this novel and some new people that come into the building. But the novel I'm writing now is back set in England, and it's about childhood sweethearts who get together in the 80s when I would have had a childhood sweetheart, and find themselves again later in the 20s, 2010s, in difficult places in their lives, and they're reunited.
Probably through Friends Reunited or something.
Oh, well, that Friends Reunited's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it?
It sure has. Thank you so much for talking to
us. You're very welcome.
Elizabeth.
Lovely to talk to you.
And you too. So just to remind everyone who's listening, of course, I was talking to the very witty Elizabeth Noble, and her new book is called The Girl Next Door, and it's published by Michael Joseph. Sounds like a great read. Well, that's all from me this week. week. Some really uplifting stuff for this Mother's Day.
Listen and log on to the Voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.